This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Real life never quite measured up to life in the theater when Frank Rich was young. He did his best to spend as much time in the theater as possible. He got only deeper into theater as he got older. From 1980 to 93, he was the chief drama critic for the New York Times. Since 1994, he's written an op-ed column that usually focuses on the intersection of culture and politics. Now he's written a memoir about how he fell in love with theater. It's called Ghost Light. A ghost light is a single light left burning in center stage when a theater is empty. The source of the term is a superstition that a ghost will move in if the theater is left completely dark. Rich grew up in suburban Washington, D.C. On his first trip to Broadway, he felt that was where he was meant to be.
Bells Are Ringing was the first time I came to New York, the first show I actually saw on Broadway at the Schubert Theater. And by that point, I had already been fantasizing about New York and Broadway and the theater for 2 or 3 years. I had been really hooked into it, and I felt adrift in where I actually lived, which was a very provincial suburbia, and then Washington, D.C. of the 1950s, late 1950s. And somehow this place with all this activity, all this excitement, all this show business as well, just seemed to me a place I wanted to inhabit. I also, as a kid, had tremendous problems with insomnia. And I love the idea of New York as a place, unlike Washington, where they didn't roll up the sidewalks at night and where there was lights, there was action, and of course, there was theater.
Was that comforting in a way that, you know, everything wasn't expected to be calm and quiet and peaceful and sleepy at night? There was tumult. There were other people who were awake or probably other people who couldn't sleep.
Totally. I felt a sense of community with these strangers. I felt just watching people walk at a fast pace in Midtown Manhattan, watching all the dazzlement of Broadway, I felt there are other people like me. I was sort of not a terribly happy kid, and I was sort of a lonely kid, and I felt, gee, there are all these people, some of them young, some of them old, who share my passions and share the kind of life that I sort of fantasized of having, of never having to go to sleep at a certain time, of being able to go to a show every night, listen to a record whenever I wanted to, or just go out on the street and find some excitement.
You've basically said that theater was, an escape from reality and also a place where you could find solace from some of the things that were really disturbing to you as a child. What were some of the problems you were experiencing in your personal life?
Well, my parents got divorced when I was about 7 years old, separated and then divorced. And it's hard for people to remember this now who weren't alive then, but divorce, never a great experience for anyone involved, including a child, was in those days something just not talked about. It was closeted. It was something people talked about in a whisper as if it were cancer. I knew no other children my age whose parents were divorced. It was painful. And it was also scary in the sense that, again, this seems like, 200 years ago rather than just 40 years ago, but parents didn't really tell their children what was going on. So there was this sense that you never knew what was going to happen to you next. You knew you were in this broken home. You knew you might have to keep moving and change schools, which I had to do. You didn't even know that your parents might remarry, which in my case, both my parents did. So that was really, really a hard thing to deal with. And another part of it had to do with the culture. I watched TV. I was part of the first TV generation. And like most kids, I watched, Father Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver and I Love Lucy, The Honeymooners, all those great shows. But you never saw a divorce on them either. You only saw happily married couples with happy children. So you felt a real estrangement from everything, from the world you inhabited and even from the fictional world you watched every night on TV. So somehow I sort of saw the theater as a place where maybe a kind of nonconformity and a kind of unhappiness would be accepted and perhaps, ameliorated in some way.
Well, as you point out in your memoir, even mainstream shows like Damn Yankees, there's a marriage that's falling apart. The Music Man, the little boy's growing up without a father. That really moved you.
It really did. And, at the time, I realize it now, and of course write about in this book, but at the time, it was happening almost at a subconscious level. in retrospect, when I look back, when I was writing this book, it was fascinating to me that, and exactly as you say, these shows we think of as sort of jolly American musicals of the golden age really have this kind of dysfunctional family thing going on, parents separated from children. Look at a show like Carousel, a teenage girl growing up whose father is a suicide and who wants to run away from home. All this stuff spoke to me, and it was the one place I could find it. I couldn't find it in TV. I couldn't find it in, you know, Doris Day, Rock Hudson movies or whatever else was around then. So I just gravitated toward it. And The Music Man is a great example because we think of that as being the sunny 76 trombones, all-American musical. But what's going on there? There's a boy without a father. It's never explained. The surrogate father comes to town, this sort of basically a bunkum artist. And in some ways, I realize in retrospect, that paralleled my own household situation.
Frank Rich is my guest. He has a new memoir about his early love of theater called Ghostlight. During this period when you were discovering theater, you were also having trouble sleeping. There were fears, I think, that surfaced at night. You had insomnia. Would you describe some of your memories of what it's like to be a kid who can't sleep?
To be a kid who can't sleep is, I'd say, even all these years later, the most terrifying thing I've ever known in my life. It is, you don't know where it's coming from. You don't know what it's about. And particularly in the time I went through it, when things like psychoanalysis or therapy were not that common and none of it was offered to me in any event, you're completely in the dark. And I just remember, and I can still, almost like a sense memory, as they say in acting, put my finger on the feelings of extreme anxiety and fear. I think in retrospect, I do know what caused a lot of it, and really it was a sense that something was happening to me that I had no control of and didn't even know the details of, because I knew that there was something unusual in the fact that my parents broke up. I knew there was something unusual in the fact that I kept switching elementary schools, but I didn't have the big picture. I didn't have the capability to understand the big picture, even if I'd had it. So it was just this kind of abject terror, tossing and turning.
Did you have any friends at school who shared your interest in theater?
I had a few friends who shared some of the interest in theater, not with the intensity that I had. But at that time, to be sort of a middle-class kid, theater was still somewhat central to American culture in a way it isn't now. When My Fair Lady became a big hit, you know, in 1956 when I was 7, everyone knew its songs. That wouldn't happen with a Broadway show today. But no one had the passion or obsession with it, I should say, that I did, that I knew about. And it was very, very, and my obsession with it was very much a minority interest.
You know, you went to a couple of camps. You went to one camp that was largely like a sports camp and felt
right.
Really alienated and lost there because you weren't very good at sports. But then you went to an arts camp, and you loved it because a lot of kids there were interested in music and in theater. You had one, particularly good friend there.
Right. Yes, it was a big change for me. When I was 13, my mother, sort of in despair about the fact that there was no sort of way for me to pursue my interest at my school or among my peers, found an ad for a camp in the back of the New York Times Sunday magazine, sent for the brochure, and decided to send me there. And it was eye-opening because it was full of kids from New York City. It was in the Berkshires in Massachusetts, full of kids who went to like progressive schools in Greenwich Village and who were from, in some cases, show business families or cultural families. For instance, Arlo Guthrie went there. It was before he was famously Arlo Guthrie, but of course, even at the time, we knew who his father, Woody, was. And there were people sort of from the fringes of the New York music and theater world. And suddenly I was with all these kids, all of whom were wearing black all the time before it was cool.
Oh, you didn't have to wear camp colors, huh?
You didn't have to wear camp color. No, the only camp color acceptable was black. And so it was great that I met some kids who opened up the world to me. And ultimately I was becoming a teenager. And so I could eventually go visit these kids and see shows with them in New York, and it made a real difference.
One of your good friends from this arts camp was the son of the writer who wrote Fiddler on the Roof. So when Fiddler on the Roof was doing its tryouts before going to Broadway, and it came to Washington, you got in to see it. You got in to see a rehearsal. I thought it was really interesting. From the rehearsal, you weren't expecting the show to be very good, but opening night, you loved it.
Well, it was a real lesson for me, you know. It just goes to show, for all my interest in the theater and going to theater at age 14 or so, I really didn't know that much about it. So my friend, whose name was Harry Stein, his father, Joe Stein, had at this point a rather checkered career in show business. And this show, Fiddler on the Roof, was thought to be not much before it opened. And we came home from camp in August, and it was trying out in Washington, D.C. at the National Theater. And Harry and I were indeed invited to a technical rehearsal. And we didn't understand what was going on. The first thing that happened was Zero Mostel appears with a cigarette dangling out of his mouth and sort of muttering things, including several four-letter words. And we think, gosh, is this really what Russia was like, you know, at the turn of the century, just before the pogroms? And we didn't understand that they were cutting from the beginning to the end of musical numbers. And we watched this whole thing, and our hearts are sinking. And the show had already played Detroit before Washington and gotten a terrible review in Variety. And I still remember and write about it in the book. We come out of the lobby in the afternoon of the National Theater, and Harry turns to me and says, I cannot believe it. My father has another bomb. And I tried to cheer up my friend. Even though I totally agreed with him, I said, oh, it's not that bad. You know, maybe it'd be mediocre or something. Then that night, there was the first performance before an audience in Washington, and suddenly we realized we had seen a technical rehearsal, not the real show. And it was a fantastic, electrifying show from the moment it began, and it was a huge lesson to me, as it would be a huge lesson in the 3 weeks that followed. While the show continued to try out in Washington, we could watch it change every night and watch Jerome Robbins and the authors come in and tweak this, tweak that, add a piece of choreography, cut a scene, change a number, take something that was already good and try to perfect it. So it was a great lesson to me in the theater and art, really.
You got a lot of lessons like that, in the sense that you soon after got a job as a ticket taker at the National Theater in Washington, so you could see performances again and again, night after night, and see how they changed, how they stayed the same.
Absolutely. I mean, this is sort of a vanished era now in the theater because shows are so heavy and expensive, but in those days, every Broadway show tried out of town to get the kinks out, and Washington was one of the cities they played most frequently. And every 2 weeks, there would be a different show on its way to Broadway. Some of them would be huge hits. Some of them would be huge flops. Some would be in between. All of them would change enormously. And it was fascinating to see The Odd Couple with Walter Matthau and Art Carney, directed by Mike Nichols. I mean, I can't believe I had the good fortune to watch this every night as a teenager. Watch them pull lines out, change that poker game, change where the Pigeon Sisters were going to come in Act Two or not. It was an incredible education, and I saw a lot of great artists of the theater work that way with the gun to their heads before New York, including Peter Brook, Stephen Sondheim, Robbins, as I mentioned before, trying to improve their shows.
How did you get the job as a ticket taker? My experience is in American theater is that ticket takers are usually older women.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. In those days, it was all men or young men or boys, in my case, and all the ticket takers at the National Theater were male, and all the ushers were women. Obviously, this has all changed now. And
maybe I'm thinking of the ushers.
Yeah, the ushers, yes, and now still most ushers are women. But I got the job because I think I was hung around the theater so much and was seen so often by the manager standing in line to buy standing room or a second balcony seat that he took pity on me. And when he saw me come back for the third or fourth time to the same show and do that repeatedly, he introduced himself to me and eventually gave me a job so I wouldn't have to pay each time I came.
My guest is Frank Rich of the New York Times. His new memoir is called Ghostlight. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Frank Rich, a New York Times columnist, former theater critic, and now author of the new memoir, Ghostlight, which is about his early years as a great fan of theater, particularly music theater. As someone who has really loved theater all of your life, how did it feel when you started writing reviews to be the person in the position of sometimes writing a bad review and dashing people's dreams with that bad review?
It's difficult. It's a difficult position to be in. I never had a serious problem with it because I always had a clear idea, as my employer, the New York Times, did and does, that I was working for the newspaper. I wasn't working for the theater. I was writing for the readers of the Times, not for the people in the shows. But it's heartbreaking to write a negative review of something that is a serious effort. It's not heartbreaking to write a review of something whose only ambitions are entirely mercenary or vulgar or silly. But, you know, when you see someone like, for instance, Stephen Sondheim have a big failure on Broadway in the misproduced first production of Merrily We Roll Along, and you're writing that review for the New York Times, and you know there's great Sondheim songs in it, and you can say all that in the piece, but still you know the show doesn't work. It's hard. It's upsetting, and I can't say that that was the fun part of the job. The flip side was much more fun, walking into something like Sunday in the Park, which, by the way, a lot of people and a lot of critics didn't like, and falling in love with it and trying to champion it and bring it to people and get them interested in it.
Do you remember the first bad review you ever wrote?
Gosh. Yes, the very first play that I had to review when I came to the Times in 1980 was a play called Marlon Brando Sat Right Here, involving people that no one's ever heard of. It was done off Broadway at a dinner theater in Soho, in New York, that I never saw again. It's almost like a dream to me now. And I just remember it was about a diner in Hoboken when they were shooting on the waterfront. And the whole play consisted mainly of people in various New Jersey accents saying, you know, Marlon Brando, he sat right here. And went on for like, the waitress said it, the customer said it, went on for like 2.5 hours. And I thought, what have I done? What job am I in? But anyway, I recovered. So did the theater.
I think of your New York Times column as being in part about the theater of politics, mm-hmm. or politics as theater. How would you describe your column?
Well, my column has always been sort of predicated on the assumption that there's a place where culture, in the broadest sense, meets the news. And so you're right. I mean, I look at the cultural map of the United States at the same time I'm looking at the news and the political map of the United States, and I try to find intersections. And of course, since I've started this column, it's become easier and easier to do when we have a political campaign that's almost reaches most people through Letterman and Leno. I don't even have to strain to find these things anymore. But that's the general idea of it. And I'm just interested in cultural issues in the broader sense. For instance, take gay civil rights. To me, that is as much a cultural issue as it is a political issue. Not because they're gay people in the theater or in the arts, but because sexuality tells us, people's reaction to anyone's sexuality, whatever their orientation might be, tells us a lot about where the culture is right now.
Do you ever feel that people who are in politics are often incredibly out of touch with popular culture in America and therefore misread and misinterpret what's going on and what the motivations are and what kids are really reacting to?
I couldn't agree with you more. I think they're clueless. They're not consumers of the product. They really don't know it. I mean, the classic example was when there were hearings in the Senate about 8 years ago where Fritz Hollings, who's been railing against Hollywood this year, a Democratic senator, showed a pie fight from Love and War, a silly sitcom of the time, about a young couple, as I recall, as an example of the violence on television that was corrupting children and should be stamped out by the government. This is, these people have no context. They have no interest in culture. And it's true of both parties. It has nothing to do with ideology. I'll never forget in the 92 campaign when Clinton and Gore were speaking at a New York City, I think New York City town meeting, and a questioner said, you know, what are you going to do about culture? What are you going to do about the NEA? What are your feelings about culture? Do you like culture? Culture is very important to New York. Well, Clinton's answer was, well, I play the saxophone. And Gore's answer was, I saw Les Miserables on Broadway. And here it is 8 years later, and he's still talking about having seen Les Miserables. Granted, it's still running, but, you know, maybe at least go see The Lion King or something. And I needn't tell you that I don't mean to pick on them, but, you know, George W. Bush is on record of not being able to remember a single book he read in childhood and not even seeing much of pop culture because he goes to bed so early. So and hadn't been to a movie, I think, in a movie theater the entire time he's been governor of Texas. So it doesn't serve them or the country well for these people to then talk about regulating culture.
Well, Frank Rich, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Frank Rich's new memoir is called Ghostlight. He writes an op-ed column for the New York Times. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.